And I sort of looked ahead and saw that if I didn't get something else to do, I might be put on part-time.
Yeah.
I had an inkling of that because one of the teachers in the language department, I don't remember his name now, he's retired, and I just don't recall the name, but I remember very well that he was put on part-time teaching because he didn't have students enough to put on for a full-time. Our full-time then was much bigger than what it is now. We had 15 hours a week teaching, and now I think the full-time teachers teach 9 hours or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But at 15 hours, you have no time for research, but fortunately, as I mentioned in the very early interview here, President Kent, when he conferred with me coming to Louisville for the first time, informed me that I was expected to teach mathematics and I wouldn't be required to do mathematical research. Of course, now, as you well know, a professor or an assistant professor might get the job to start with and probably wouldn't here unless he showed some signs of being able to do research. But Dr. Kent assured me, as I indicated in the previous interview, he assured me that my job was to be teaching mathematics, and as I indicated then, I think I felt I did a pretty good job of that. I would have done a horrible job as a research mathematician because I didn't have the ability to do it. And as I indicated before, I wasn't willing to have published the kind of things that I could do.
I think you should say that you didn't have the time to find out if you had the ability.
No,
I think you're being too hard on yourself.
I'm frank enough to tell you, and I insist on it, that I didn't have the ability to do good research in mathematics. I could have done the kind of research that frequently is done in mathematics, which is simply to look up what somebody else has done and report on it. But that's not research in mathematics, as I understand it. It might be in history, it might be in English, and probably is in languages, but it certainly is not good research in mathematics. The research in mathematics comes when you invent or describe some new field and work in it, just as, for example, analytic geometry was not known to the ancients. It was finally developed in the Middle Ages. Calculus was not known until the time of Newton and Leibniz. Nobody even thought of the idea, and it turned out to be an exceedingly valuable process, but it wasn't known prior to Newton's time and prior to Leibniz's time, as far as I know. So this is the kind of thing that I mean by research in mathematics, and I was incapable of doing that kind of thing. I knew that, and I wasn't willing to spend the time doing the other kind of research. Well, I can give one example that I did, which would indicate that kind of research, and I wouldn't have allowed the paper to be published if I had written it up. I didn't write it up, but I gave a program down at the University of Kentucky at one of the mathematics meetings in which I announced the discovery that I had made that division by zero was possible, a statement which goes contrary to most textbooks in the mathematics, which said division by zero is impossible. Well, just to keep the record straight, the statement should read that division of zero by zero is impossible. You can't come up with a specific answer, but this work that I did in connection with projective geometry, incidentally, was to show that the division of any number A by zero always turned out to be the point that you had labeled infinity. And that meant, for me at least, that division by zero was possible. But this is the kind of thing, which I had discovered on my own, the kind of thing that I wouldn't have wanted to put into a paper to be published, because I don't think it's important enough to do that. And I would have received a lot of comments by other mathematicians saying that it was impossible because you can't find infinity. Well, you can't on any other geometry except in projective geometry.
Mm-hmm.
And in projective geometry, you can label three points on a line, one of them zero, the other one one, and the other one infinity. And on the basis of those, you can set up a drawing which is equivalent, and a professor at Princeton proved that it was technically equivalent to ordinary multiplication.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that thing that led me to the discovery that whenever I divided any number A by zero, I came up with a point infinity on the line.
Mm-hmm.
Very definite. There was no ambiguity about it. So I gave that talk down at the University of Kentucky, which the audience, I guess, enjoyed. I didn't mind doing that because this was for the spring meeting that we had.
Yeah.
There were a lot of topics that were even more trivial than the one I gave down there.
You were talking about your how this related to your interest in astronomy.
Well, astronomy, we started that a minute ago and then I got sidetracked. Astronomy, as I had sense enough when I started teaching it to go to University of Chicago. And I went during the summer. I spent 2 weeks at Yerkes Observatory at the University of Chicago. And much to my amazement, when I got there, I was given a key to the observatory where I could come and go as I pleased and go anywhere as I wanted to. And so I used to visit with the people there who were research astronomers while they were doing their research at the big telescope, the 40-inch. I didn't get a chance to look through it, and I wasn't interested. I wanted information about what I could do in teaching the astronomy. And they were very much interested in giving me that information because, as you know, astronomers back in those days, this was 1931, astronomers in those days needed to have graduate students. The only way they get them is they get students interested in undergraduate in astronomy, and it can only be done by people like myself who was willing to teach astronomy. And as I indicated to you, I think in another interview, I had one student who really turned out to be top-notch in that field of optics, which is associated with astronomy.
Yeah.
Well, when I came back here then, I started this course in astronomy, and that gave me another 3 hours so that I didn't have to go on part-time. And also, it was along about that same time that I became interested in the development of these courses in general science that I mentioned before. And that kept me real busy, and my time was very well filled out, so that there was no time that I know of that ever contemplated putting me on part-time. Then, I don't remember the year now, but I think it was around 1932, maybe, that I got acquainted with two people here in Louisville, and one of them was Charles Strull, who was a real estate lawyer, and the other one was Oscar McCarty, and he was a paint salesman for Bridges Smith.
Yeah.
But McCarty was also very much interested in Boy Scouts. And both of these men were very much interested in astronomy. McCarty was running a mini course in astronomy out at the Boy Scout camp at Covered Bridge, and Mr. Strahl was running a course for the YWCA in astronomy. And when I got acquainted with these men, I was also interested in doing some public lectures for astronomy in 1932. After I started teaching it, I became interested in the subject itself. And for a while, I did quite a bit of lecturing on astronomy. And these two men and myself got together and said, well, let's organize and have a society. And we called ourselves the Astronomical Society of Louisville. And so we started it up. And one of my students at that time, Milton Shapinski, was the secretary, I remember. I don't remember now who was president, probably either McCarty or Strahl, because I became president later, but not for the first few meetings. So we organized this course in astronomy, this group in astronomy, which is still going strong. They're very active. And we met once a month and met in the university lecture lounge associated with the old library. And we had our meetings there once a month. Well, we didn't go into astronomy at that time very long before there were several of us that were interested in instrumentation. And you mentioned whether I had any support from the University of Louisville. Well, I didn't receive any actual support. I was permitted to do it. And of course, I got paid for teaching it, but I had no budget. And there was no money for equipment. So I got interested, along with this student I was telling you about, in doing the development of an instrument for astronomy. And I built several telescopes, one 6-inch, then an 8-inch, and finally a 10-inch, which I dropped on concrete and broke in the process of developing it. And finally, I did a 12-inch, which I realized very soon. The 12-inch came quite soon after I had started teaching astronomy, because I had a basement shop and did this work as a hobby in my shop at home. And the 12-inch telescope pointed out to me, which is very obvious, of course, that you can see more things with a bigger telescope. So then I began to be interested in a good telescope, in addition to the ones that I could build. And in that process, I became acquainted through Mr. Strahl with a certain, I'll get it here in a minute, a certain Miller, who was head president of the Miller Paper Company at that time. And he had been in the Army in World War II. This was after World War II. He had been in the Army and had contracted some kind of disease which made it impossible for him to do observations. And he had an excellent 12-inch telescope made by the Clark people, who were one of the major professional telescope builders at that time. And he had this telescope and invited me out to his farm that he had in the east end of Louisville. I don't remember now exactly where it was, but it was in that area where a lot of people had little farms. That they weren't big ones, but they were little ones that they had out there. And he invited me there, and we observed through his telescope. And I was very much entranced with it, because it was better than the ones I had built, obviously. And so he was concerned, because he couldn't do observation himself. He'd really done a lot towards developing some research in astronomy before he went into the Army. I don't know what his position in the Army was. I don't don't know that. But anyway, he was unable to use this instrument, and he was commenting to Mr. Strahl that what in the world could he do with this telescope, because he couldn't use it and he hated to just put it away. Mr. Strahl says, "Why don't you give it to the University of Louisville?" So he contacted me and wanted to know if I'd be interested in that telescope. And since it wasn't going to cost us anything, I said, "But sure." I was very much interested in it. So this incidentally brings up another rather interesting thing, which is a sideline. When I got interested in astronomy in 1932, I used to take the telescope that I built and put it in the car and take it out into the county.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife didn't like it because I was away from home at night so much.
Yeah.
And so she began looking around and found the place where we now live. At that time was out in the country, way out.
Yeah.
Now, of course, it's surrounded by houses. But at that time, it had a very clear sky and very excellent. So we found that the price was reasonable, and we moved out in 1933,
huh,
where we are now located. And it had a log house and a little garage, and incidentally, we had a tub of one of those steel drums of hot water up on the garage, and that was heated by sunshine, and then the water would run down in, and that was what we used for taking our baths and so on. So we were in on solar work long before it became popular. And at that time, then, my wife was interested that I move out there, so we moved out. And that's when I really began to build telescope, because the sky was much better than the sky here at the university. But in 1936, Mr. Miller gave us this telescope, which is a beautiful thing, gave it to the University of Louisville, along with the observatory that he had, which was a kind of a ramshackle building with a roll-off roof.
Mm-hmm.
And he dumped the building pieces, and even delivered the whole thing out here at the university, and Dr. Stevenson and myself undertook to take it apart in such a way that we could put it back together again. So I don't know whether you know where the old playhouse was.
Yeah, right. All here. Right.
Uh-huh.
Right here.
It
was right here where this building is.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, We had a little building out west of the playhouse, and we put this observatory out there.
Huh.
And even though Louisville had plenty of lights at that time, this was 1936, still we were down in the trees, and therefore the sky that was available to us was really fairly decent, and the telescope did good work.
Good.
And it lasted for until the Natural Science Building was built, and then we moved the telescope to the top of the Natural Science Building.
I see.
And then the old building was destroyed, much to the relief of the president. I don't remember which president was at that time, but he didn't like the looks of that building because it was really a tacky looking thing.
What did you call it? Did you call it the observatory?
We just called it the observatory. It didn't have a name.
What did it look like? Describe it to me.
It was just a square building with a roll-away roof that you could roll off and roll off to the north on rollers, and then your telescope was out open to the sky.
Was it wooden?
Yeah,
wooden building. Was it bigger than this room?
Yes, but not much.
Yeah.
It's just big enough for a telescope.
Yeah, I see, you know. I see. So this room's what?
I had some pictures of it once, but unfortunately they got burned up.
Yeah.
And but anyway, we had this building, and then when the National Science Building was built, I inveigled the university to move the telescope up on the top floor of the National Science Building. And that involved something else again. I had a student in analytic geometry by the name of Maria de Ritter, and her father was a design specialist for Reynolds Metals Company.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got acquainted with Maria, and she liked me a little bit, and so she got her father to invite me over. This was in after 1936 by quite a bit. I don't remember exactly when the National Science Building was built. But anyway, she got her father interested, and he designed the observatory, which is now on top of the roof of the
And that same telescope is there.
Yeah, that's the one that's up there now.
Yeah.
And De Ritter got Reynolds Metals to give us the aluminum,
mm-hmm.
but they wouldn't put up any money toward building it. And I recall, the university spent about $6,000 to get the telescope built.
Uh-huh.
And this was on the campus. But in the meantime, this was done, I think, about 1945, something like that. See, I had the Millerscope out here in their little building for quite a while. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, even the Miller telescope, as good as it was, didn't satisfy me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided that the time had come when I was feeling my oats in optics and decided that anybody could build a good telescope if you only took time enough to do it. So it was around about 1936, as I recall, about the time I got this Miller telescope, that I decided to build a bigger telescope. And so I was at that time acquainted with the, by letter only, I've never met him, but I was acquainted with the editor, Mr. Ingalls, of the Scientific American.
Uh-huh.
And I wrote to Ingalls that I was interested in this telescope, and he said, well, you should get the glass from Corning, because they had just completed the glass for the 400-inch telescope in California.
Mm-hmm.
And they could supply telescopes of any size with the same formula
mm-hmm.
that they use for the glass for the big 400-inch. So I wrote to Corning Glass Company, and they quoted me a price, which was beyond my capacity at that time, of $300 for such a glass of 20 inches, 21 inches in diameter. But they said if you could only get five other people to buy one, we could then sell you this same glass for 180.
I see.
So I wrote my problems to Ingalls, and he persuaded the Scientific American, I don't think they've ever done it with anybody else, he persuaded them to put in an advertisement for free in Scientific American to see if there's anybody interested in building a 20-inch telescope.
What year, I'm just curious, what year would that have been in science?
This was about 1936, as I recall. The reason I think it was 1936 is what's coming up next on this. So this ad went in the Scientific American sometime during 1936. I don't remember the exact date. If you have copies of the magazine, you will find it in there, of the to the effect that if anybody is interested in building a 20-inch telescope, consult Dr. Walter Moore of the University of Louisville, and if he can get five people, why, he'll be able to get the blank cheaper.
Ah.
Then along came a letter from, shortly after this ad, along came a letter from Corning Glass Company saying that they had received orders for the necessary four other people, and if I wanted the telescope, the glass blank, then I could have it for $180. So I persuaded the society, which is then very active,
mm-hmm.
by the way, I persuaded them to support and sell tickets to a lecture that I was going to give. It's in the later part of 1936, a lecture I was going to give, or early part of 1937. I don't remember which. I'm going to give a series of lectures in the, I gave them in a room in the old women's building where they housed the home ec building. Uh-huh. And the society sold more tickets than we could possibly get people into the room, because people saw that what we were going to do with the money, that was part of the publicity that we got. Through Mr. Strahl, we got very good publicity in the Courier Journal because he had some pull down there. So so I gave this series of lectures, and I don't remember what the charge was for the tickets. I had the information at one time, but it's lost. And I remember, though, that we cleared about almost $400, not quite. And the society had enough money so that we had altogether about $500 in funds. So then we decided we were going to build a 20-inch telescope. And there were about a dozen members of the society. Unfortunately, I didn't keep a record. I should have, but I didn't. That's one of the mistakes I made, to keep a record of all the people that were involved. Of course, if I had, it wouldn't have done any good because that record would have been burned up. But I remember a few of them. One of them was Wilbur Johnson, who was an electronics expert. Another one was Kenneth McElwain, and he was the real spark plug on that. He was a machinist, very good one. He worked for Louisville Gas and Electric and did work on their electrical machinery down there. He was very, very good. And he got interested in it. And then we ordered the glass from Corning with the funds that we had from this lecture series. Well, I didn't have to work through a Louisville Foundation. There wasn't any such thing then, so I had the money in my own account, which I kept separate from my own money, and used that to buy the glass. Then another member of the society, who was president, Mr. Burke, president of the Central Glass Company, he persuaded the suppliers of his company, Pittsburgh Glass Company, to make up a blank out of plate glass, or just ordinary green glass, for a tool for this 20-inch mirror. We made it the same size and same shape as the 20-inch. And when the telescope, when the mirror got here at Louisville, we incidentally had one of the men from Corning, who was responsible for developing the telescope at Mount Palomar, 400-inch. He was interested. He was the superintendent at that time. He happened to be in Louisville, and so he came to give a talk to our society and told about the making of telescope mirrors and that sort of thing. And then I had the problem. I knew we could do the mirror. There were about 12 of us all together. In addition to Johnson and McElwain, there was Stanley Thorpe, who was a manual arts teacher, and of course very good in that. Then there was Lewis Aker, who was head of the chemistry department of Louisville Gas and Electric Company. And then there was Charles Bruce, who was a bridge designer for the L&N Railroad. He was very much interested in it. And Richard Holzbach, who was a, I don't know what you would call him, he was a machine designer, but he worked independently. He didn't work for anybody. He did independent work and sold his ideas to different places that needed them. He was very good, though, for design. And so I had this problem, how to get the